Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how much does race and class determine legal outcomes in the United States? What role does the prosecutor play in the justice system? And first, rage and a desire for vengeance after 9/11 drove the United States to violate human rights on a mass scale. What were those mistakes and what lessons do they offer to others dealing with political violence? How much does rage and demands for vengeance undermine peace? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel and Israel's militarized response, both Israelis and Palestinian civilians have been targets for violence and killing. The prospect for a ceasefire and meaningful peace negotiations between Israel and Palestine seem today all the more distant. President Biden, when he traveled to Israel to offer American support to the Israelis, added a caution about Israel's response to the attack. He said, and this is a quote, "I caution that while you feel the rage, don't be consumed by it. After 9/11, we were enraged in the United States. While we sought justice and got justice, we also made mistakes." Today, we explore what were those mistakes. How did rage and a demand for vengeance lead the U.S. to military aggression and human rights abuses in the name of fighting the global war on terror? And what do these mistakes say about rage following an attack that could simply lead to more violence? Today, I'm joined by Brent Sasley. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, Arlington. He's written extensively on emotion and politics, historical memory, and specifically on Israel and the Oslo Peace Accords. And Steve Swerdlow, Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He writes extensively as a human rights monitor for Human Rights Watch as well. Thank you both very much for joining us. Brent, when I first read this quote, "Don't make the same mistakes we made post 9/11, what were the biggest mistakes the U.S. made?
Well, first, thanks for having me on, Doug. The biggest mistake, of course, is not planning for what came after. There was a pretty clear idea that there had to be a military response. States have the right to self-defense. They have the right to take action. Even the UN Charter allows them, although it doesn't say anything specific about carrying a war to a foreign country. But there was a pretty clear sense that some kind of military response was needed. Some people raised the question or the issue of, well, what are you going to do afterward? And how are you going to manage or control that military response? Because once you let that military response kind of take on a momentum of its own, that tends to lead to more destruction, more civilian casualties. And so I think the biggest problem in both Afghanistan and Iraq was that the United States had no clear plan, or at least they didn't have a detailed enough plan for what to do afterwards that also included regional actors. Because what's also clear is that the U.S. could not have done anything like this on its own.
This lack of a plan, is it fair to say that a lot of the military response is just kind of lashing out at whoever the U.S. perceived was responsible for the attacks, rather than any sort of positive vision for what peace might look like?
Yeah, there's some interesting studies that show that the United States, in terms of its population, in terms of its elites, in terms of its decision makers, that humiliation was something that characterized their response. And if you look at their statements and the things that they said and how they characterized what they were going to do, you can see that there was a sense of shock, surprise, and a real sense of anger. I would even use the word vengeance, but certainly a sense of this, how did this happen to us? This couldn't have happened to us. And a lashing out because of that. I'm not saying that there were no efforts, no discussions, no policy discussions about how to do this, but it's pretty clear that they were limited in scope.
And Steve, I mean, one of the things that struck me about the U.S. response post 9/11 was just how irrelevant a lot of the human rights discourses that have preceded 9/11, you know, seem to be. One of the lessons that I seem to draw from all this is, when nations feel any sort of fear, insecurity, or shock or whatever, they just really seem to lose their commitment to human rights. Am I too pessimistic here?
Well, I think you're right to focus on fear. And again, thanks for having me on. This is a real honor. And I'll just start with a the personal note that as every person who was living at the time, I remember it so vividly. I was in New York on that day, was watching the towers fall and watching it all unfold, living in that city, coming together, tragic events. And also now I have relatives and family and friends in Israel. And so very closely feel what's happening. But I think you're absolutely right to focus on this particular very dangerous moment for human rights, this fearful moment. I'm thinking about the response after 9/11. You know, I was reading what Obama said a few days ago on Medium. He said, America itself has at times fallen short of our higher values when engaged in war. And in the aftermath of 9/11, the U.S. government wasn't interested in heeding the advice of even our allies when it came to the steps we took to protect ourselves against Al-Qaeda. You know, I think that's a very softly, very understated way to remind us of what happened. Brent mentioned the international response. When we think about the way in which the United States betrayed its own commitment to the Geneva Conventions, I remember back to those first few days when Donald Rumsfeld justified not applying prisoner of war status to the Taliban in the first month or so, I believe it was October 2001, when we first started to learn about Guantanamo and the really tenuous legal footing on which it would be based. There was a lot of improvisation, just really a shredding of so many of the things that the U.S. had itself invested into building up in the international legal framework, the international human rights framework, from the Geneva Conventions to the authorization for the use of force. We remember now Barbara Lee, the only congressperson who voted against that authorization, which ended up being a blank check for endless military intervention around the globe. And also at that time, concomitantly with the international response, which was so, in a way, hostile to human rights doctrine, we also had the FBI opening up raids and surveillance on mosques and in Muslim communities across the U.S. in a way that really stirred up fear and summoned the worst aspects of our history, the darkest moments going back to, you know, our history of racism. And so it was a time, as you noted, Doug, where the world was for some time united and sympathized greatly. And living in New York, I certainly felt that with the United States, but very quickly we dispensed with that goodwill. Rather than heed what international human rights instruments have to say, rather than look really closely at the UN Charter, as Brent just mentioned, there was this decision to just embrace a sort of American exceptionalism. And I'll just say one more final opening thought was, of course, as a lawyer, when I think about the brazenness and the violation of logic and common sense, you know, one of the things that really sticks out is the torture memos that were authored in the Department of Justice or by the State Department legal advisor and, you know, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, and these memos that laid the groundwork for the enhanced interrogation techniques. To have that argued to the public as somehow consistent with our values or as even effective in fighting terrorism was such a betrayal. And really, as someone who teaches human rights now and follows human rights in so many countries, we are still very much dealing with the aftermath of those fateful decisions to violate those principles early on in the war on terrorism. And we're still, in a way, in the war on terrorism. So I haven't addressed much of what's happening in Israel, but since we're focused on 20 years ago, I thought I'd begin with those reflections.
Certainly the U.S. suffered as a result of this being an authoritative voice on human rights. And even today, the militarization of that response has so undermined any sort of U.S., you know, claims on international law, for example, you know, claims on any sort of leadership on issues of human rights, also on aggression. Because Brent, you said post 9/11, there was a very quick coalescence around the idea the U.S. was going to militarize this response. And there's definitely voices out there that had critiqued that. I remember Richard Falk writing quite a bit about how we should have treated this much more like a criminal endeavor and, you know, much more about, you know, like international policing rather than waging war against sovereign states. How much was that the mistake? The mistake was this militarized response because, you know, of course, the implications that's had with Israel's response to the attacks, that's not the only way to respond.
No, it's not the only way to respond. If you're talking about Israel, first, we should expect that there was some kind of military response. That's sort of just the nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Also, there are several actors in the Middle East that still see violence, the use of armed force as a viable policy option. Also, the Hamas attack was, for all of its brutality and cruelty, was a military attack. And so immediately in Israel, the government and military intelligence leaders did believe that some kind of military response was necessary. What's clear is that the government, as far as we know, does not have a clear plan for what else to do or what other options to do, not to speak of even what to do afterward. And it's not clear if that's because they just really don't know what to do, because, you know, this is exactly what has happened before. And short of major change that includes the complete destruction of Hamas, it's really hard to see how we won't be back to the status quo ante. I would argue that it's clear that Israel doesn't have a plan yet for what else to do. Many Israelis, particularly Israeli Jews, are upset. But what you also see are lots and lots of voices that are still saying, I understand, you know, my children, my family were hurt, were killed, but I don't want to see Palestinian children and families hurt or killed as well. So there's lots of voices critical of the Netanyahu government. I don't see that they have had an effect on government planning just yet. I think the people in power in Israel are adept at ignoring those kinds of critical voices. So I think that we're probably going to see this only military response in the near future. One thing that might change it is the U.S. And I don't think it will be Biden saying, learn from our mistakes. I think it would be Biden saying no, or not, maybe not no, but consistent pressure to try and do something else. But I think that would be very hard. I think Israel's in a moment now, similar to the way the U.S. was, and similar kinds of governments in many ways, after 9/11, where it's really not interested in listening to some other option. I don't know when that will change. I don't know if it will change. I just don't see it changing anytime soon.
I would agree, because certainly the U.S. policy, you know, it's fairly unequivocal support for Israel in these times of crisis. That really hasn't been changed, irrespective of a line in the presidential speech that gets us thinking about this. But I think the U.S. lacked the creativity to address post 9/11 is the recognition that the current status, that the current trend isn't working. One of the things that I perceive, and, you know, Brent, you would know this better than I would, how many Israelis are saying, we had this policy really for about 23 years since the collapse of Oslo, and there was this perception that this could work, this could persist. Yes, it was resulting in horrific living conditions in Gaza, but we could manage this crisis. I remember hearing Israelis say, this isn't about conflict resolution, it's about conflict management at this point. We just need to manage the conflict. The conflict was not really being managed. And so how frustrated should we be that we're at this moment when we know it's not working, but that our expectations were just going to go back to a situation we know that doesn't work?
The short answer is very. So we were comparing it to the U.S., but there's another comparison also, which is the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. So, you know, in that war, Israel responded to exchanges of fire skirmishes. It was pretty clear that, I won't say that it was a policy of vengeance, but this idea of we need to punish them severely, that was clearly at play. And it turned out disastrous for the Lebanese. It was disastrous for Israel. It did nothing for Israel's military position or strategic position. And at the end, where Israel and Lebanon ended up back to the status quo ante. At this point, that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing the same thing play out. So yes, I'm sure it's frustrating for people in Israel and Palestine and around the region, certainly frustrating for outside analysts who are trying to think of it a little bit more broadly and trying to take a step back as much as we can, given the suffering that's going on. But, you know, to try and say, we need to think more carefully, because clearly, as you said, for decades, this wasn't working. And if we're just going back to that exact same spot, then what is the point of, not that there's any point to the human suffering, but all we're doing is creating more death and suffering, and people are losing families and children. It's not a smart place to be, even putting aside the moral issue. It's just not a smart place to be policy-wise.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the way in which rage leads to policies that just produce more violence. Looking at the U.S. response post 9/11, perhaps some lessons between Israel and Palestine after the October 7th attacks. Our guests today are Brett Sasley from the University of Texas Arlington and Steve Swerdlow from the University of Southern California. And Steve, when I think about the American again, this response post 9/11 and this kind of, you know, turning the US's back on human rights and sort of this demand for vengeance here, the US really seemed to lose its way, lose its values, but recognize that had to kind of blind a lot of Americans to that with policies like the black sites and the renditions, which were not in the United States, obviously, the refusal to use the American court system in any prosecution of anybody tied to 9/11, instead sending them to Guantanamo Bay and even having military tribunals in Guantanamo, you know, for that. So what sorts of lessons should we take from this about not just questions of commitments to human rights, but also the reality that the U.S. tried to hide, at least in some cases, what it was doing, at least for a while?
Yeah, no, really important question. You know, I do think that, you know, really thoughtful people in the years after 9/11, as the enhanced interrogation program was first exposed for torture, but then also later for its lack of effectiveness, that really did bring forth really important lessons for foreign policy, for the fighting or combating violent extremism, what to do, what not to do. And I, of course, look at all these human rights implications, but when I'm teaching about 9/11, I certainly like to cite Ali Soufan, the FBI interrogator who before 9/11 had been tracking Al-Qaeda and had interrogated suspects using legal conventional techniques in trying to ferret out, collect information about potential terrorist attacks. Listening to what he had to say in the post 9/11 period, when the interrogation was handed over to the CIA and when waterboarding, and which took place in black sites, was used, it didn't yield actionable or credible intelligence. And we've seen very recently, still the Guantanamo trials are stalling one after another. We had one defendant recently severed. And what has this done in effect? It has deprived the victims and the families of the 9/11 tragedy of accountability, of justice. At the time, we knew that our federal courts, I worked for a federal court judge, I know personally, we could have handled that process in a professional, safe way that would have delivered justice. And I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned that can be applied to Israel's situation. We have the International Criminal Court, which did open an investigation 2 years ago into the events in Israel-Palestine. Palestine, of course, has ceded to the jurisdiction, Israel has not. But we have this mechanism, this non-military global mechanism, which lawyers and activists and human rights scholars have worked on creating over 20 years. And yet that institution is not being used. It's being shunted aside. We've seen in the past few days this increasing hostility between Antonio Guterres and Netanyahu. It's really unfortunate. Of course, it only serves to further deepen the problems. And the U.S., even 2 years into the Ukraine war, even though we're now cooperating with the ICC in its investigation, we've still also ourselves not signed up to it. And I think this persistent reluctance to adopt international law and international human rights law as the rules of the road, as in some ways, it's, of course, it requires concessions, it requires ceding sovereignty, but what I think it ultimately guarantees is a more commonsensical, fair approach to dealing with these existential problems of national security and terrorism. This is exactly what these institutions were created for. And so it's frustrating to see that cycle of history keep repeating itself. Of course, you mentioned the black sites and the U.S. alliance with countries like Uzbekistan during the dark days of the war on terror. It brought out the worst aspects. And I think of that also in relation to Israel as an important democracy. You know, the protests before October 7th that shed light on Israel's own existential struggle to remain a democracy. I think we have to remember that, and hopefully these events in a way don't lead Israel down a 20-year odyssey of a war on terror, but maybe more quickly recenter the importance of the democratic institutions, the checks and balances, the separation of power, those democratic institutions, which I think will allow Israel to prevail and hopefully handle this in a way that doesn't include all these dark chapters like we've had.
Could I add to that?
Please.
Oh, I was just going to say, to the extent that the United States has, and I suppose we can debate that, I think the U.S., to Steve's point, I think the U.S. has the capacity or had the capacity to move back to what it was before. I mean, I share Steve's concerns, but I don't want to sound pessimistic. I can't imagine that happening under the current government. And sadly, there is no political party or movement that has the support to win power to make those changes. And I mean, I completely agree, but I mean, sadly, I think to Steve's point, we may well be in this position, or at least Israel and Palestine will be in this position for some years to come. I mean, we've been in this position for a number of years, but if Netanyahu does finally fall from power after this, again, we'll see who's able to take power, but I don't imagine anyone who's interested in international law the way they should be, right? And the way that we would want them to be for the same reasons that Steve was just talking about, which is depressing and makes a, you know, it puts us in a really bad place, but at the same time makes the necessity for promoting international law all that more urgent. So I didn't want to just throw in that kind of depressing note, but.
No, I know, absolutely. I wonder how much though that the international recognition that what Israel has been doing with its militarized response in Gaza to this point, we're recording on Thursday, the 26th, the so-called, you know, the ground invasion that everybody's been talking about hasn't happened, but the expectation would be when it does, violations of international law, and in particular, the devastating effect this is going to have on Palestinian civilians and in Gaza, Israel's come under quite a bit of criticism, a good amount of it justified on violations of international law. But the pessimist in me says Israel's been criticized on violations of international law and human rights for a number of years now, and the Israelis seem pretty immune, you know, to that. Brent, is there any hope that, especially if it comes from the United States, that maybe Israel's attitudes about international critiques of its occupation might change?
I think that there is some space under certain conditions, and those conditions are limited. So the International Court of Justice a number of years ago, made a ruling about the security barrier. And at least in part as a response to that, the Israeli government did shift the barrier where it loops through the West Bank and Palestinian villages and towns, made some small adjustments. And it looks, you know, there were other reasons, domestic reasons, but part of it was this belief that there, you know, one way to get the international community off our back is to at least follow to some extent this or take it as seriously. This government just has no interest in that. And, you know, if you look at what many people in Israel on the right, especially those in government, they're adamant that their response, there's no quarter to be given. They're very clear on this, that this was just, for them, a game changer. Whether that plays out in reality is, you know, but in any conversation that I've had, they've all said, no, this is what's going to happen. If Hamas cares about Palestinian lives, they will resign, they will move out. But if they don't, this is all on them.
Even with some of this really egregious practices, cutting off fuel, food, water to Gaza, that's been highlighted since the military's response. That's, in essence, the Israelis' attitude is...
Well, some things change. I mean, sometimes pressure can be, you know, turning off fuel or allowing some humanitarian delivery. That's one thing. That kind of militarized response is another thing. So I think you'll see a difference in terms of what pressure can bring.
It seems to me that the only way that we could see any a peace between Israel and Palestine is to somehow reinvigorate a peace process. And for all the talk about one state versus two state, the two-state solution really, in my mind, is the only pathway that both sides could potentially agree to that might bring about a peace. Steve, I'll ask you first and then finish with Brent. Is there a scenario where at some point, and not in the distant future, that we can reinvigorate this process, this peace process?
Some things that I draw hope from are the fact that some of the voices, the now more professionalized, sophisticated human rights movement, both in Palestine and Israel, at least their voices are more accessible, perhaps, than 20 years ago. I've been heartened listening to B'Tselem, or the leading Israeli human rights lawyer, Michael Sfard, or by Raj Surani in the Gaza Strip, who's undergoing attacks, but is still putting out reports. I think you have voices, and often they get drowned out, obviously, in the American mainstream media conversation. But in Israel and Palestine, if we were to pay close attention to, and of course, Brent rightly says that that's a very small constituency that's also drowned out. But we've seen Gideon Levy at Haaretz, Michael Sfard did an op-ed also right after October 7th, talking about not losing your humanity in the way you respond to these horrific crimes by Hamas. I've been heartened to see that. I think the prescriptions for, again, a more sober, rights-respecting policy are being put forward. We just have to listen to them. We have to privilege those voices. And maybe in our decentralized YouTube media environment, maybe there's a way in which the playing field slightly changes now. Although I have to say, today as we're recording this, I learned that an Al Jazeera reporter, the main Al Jazeera correspondent in Gaza, almost his entire family was wiped out in a bomb attack. And it's incredibly difficult when we don't have, in a bombing, it's incredibly difficult when there are no correspondents inside, right now we're at the hottest moment of this catastrophe. And I think it's just really important that everyone who can repeat the message again and again, that atrocities do not justify atrocities. Cooler heads have to prevail. These were absolutely horrific crimes and war crimes and atrocities committed by Hamas, but there's simply no justification for this cycle of atrocities continuing. And so I would say that I think the way we get to a better place is by doing our very best. And maybe, you know, this happens in the media and academia, in policy think tanks, in various circles, and in government, hopefully, to, for a change, pay attention to international human rights law obligations and let that guide us to the extent it can. But I know that may be, again, a little, as for Brent and for you, Doug, perhaps overly optimistic. But I think as you started out with this program, we don't need to relive the war on terror. And let's hope we won't have to again.
Yeah, and Brent, I'll give you the last word on this.
I agree 100% with what Steve said. I think we on the outside do have to rethink our approach to the extent that we can have any kind of influence. If we want international law to be relevant, then we have to make it relevant. And we do have to constantly promote it and talk about it, as difficult as it may be. So, yeah, I mean, it's always important to have hope, I think. So,
my guests have been Brent Sasley. He's the Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas in Arlington. He writes extensively on emotion and politics, on historical memory, and specifically about Israel and the Oslo peace process. And Steve Swordlow, Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. And he writes extensively as a human rights monitor for Human Rights Watch. Thank you both very much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, how much of the criminal justice system in the United States is influenced by race and class? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In the United States, prosecutors have a lot of power in the justice system. Can progressive prosecutors make it more just? Doug Becker explores with the co-author of a new book, A Fear of Too Much Justice, Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the Criminal Courts.
I'm Doug Becker. Justice in the United States is supposed to be blind. The famous Lady Justice image is blind as she weighs each case. But race and class all play significant, even defining roles in the administration of justice in the United States. On today's show, we will explore the issue of race and class in the criminal justice system. Stephen Bright and James Kwok have written a new book on this issue entitled A Fear of Too Much Justice, Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the criminal courts. Stephen Bright teaches law at Yale and Georgetown Universities and was the director of the Southern Center for Human Rights. He's also won multiple capital cases in the Supreme Court. And James Kwok is a former professor of law at the University of Connecticut and the chairperson of the board of the Southern Center for Human Rights. This is the first book for both authors. And today on the show, we have James Kwok joining us. Professor Kwok, James, if I may, thank you very, very much for joining us. First question, and this really kind of dominates the first part of the book. A lot of what gets prosecuted is based on the prosecutors themselves. How much independence does the prosecutor have? And, you know, how much of the issue of this inequality kind of rests with the role of the prosecutor?
So the prosecutor is really the most important person in the criminal legal system. I think a lot of listeners might think that the judge is more important, but prosecutors tend to have the most influence for a couple of reasons I'll talk about. So to your question, prosecutors have an enormous amount of discretion in deciding what cases they want to prosecute, and when they prosecute a case, what charges they want to bring. So perhaps the most striking example of prosecutorial discretion is in the death penalty. So whether or not to seek the death penalty, about 28 or 29 states, I believe, still have the death penalty. But in those states, the vast majority of prosecutors never seek the death penalty. So whether or not to seek the death penalty for a given murder is essentially up to the prosecutor. That's why we have a couple of things. One is that if you look at all of the executions in the modern era of the death penalty, that's going back to the mid-1970s, half of those executions arose in 2% of all counties in the United States. So one famous example is Harris County, which includes Houston in Texas, which had an extremely pro-death penalty district attorney for a couple of decades. And as a result, there have been more than 100 executions coming out of Harris County. If Harris County were a state, it would be second only to the rest of Texas. Another consequence of this is the racial disparities in the application of the death penalty. So it's been known for a long time that you are more likely to be sentenced to death, all other things being equal, if you are Black. And that's possible, again, because the decision to seek the death penalty in an individual case is up to the prosecutor. And the vast majority of prosecutors in this country are white. Until a couple decades ago in the South, they were essentially all white. I'll just add one more quick thing about the power of the prosecutor. So I talked about death penalty cases. It's just as striking when you talk about small cases, so minor felonies, misdemeanors. And how does it show up there? Well, for a given set of actions, often somebody can be charged under different statutes. A given action could be charged as a felony or a misdemeanor. Prosecutors typically will threaten somebody with the most serious charges they can think of, and then try to get them to plead guilty to a lesser set of charges in exchange for a lower sentence. Prosecutors almost always win at these negotiations because people are afraid of going to trial and getting the very long sentence. And what that means is that in the vast majority of cases, the prosecutors are dictating the sentences. Right? So in this country, most people think that the judge decides what the sentence is. In practice, it's usually the prosecutor.
And one of those practices that you highlight in the book is the overcharging of cases. The prosecutors know that they're going to plead almost every case, and so they just overcharge so that when you split down the middle, that down the middle is much closer to the prosecutor's ideal than the defense. Is that
exactly? Yeah. That's exactly, yeah. True. And one reason they can get away with that, I mean, besides the fact that they're allowed to, the other reason they can get away with it is that most people accused of crimes are poor. More than 80% cannot afford a lawyer on their own. Although if you are charged with a felony, you have the right to a lawyer, how that right is granted varies widely from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And just to make things short, I'll say that the vast majority of poor people accused of crimes are given a lawyer who is at best extremely overworked and doesn't have the resources or the time to investigate their case. So when the prosecutor shows up with an offer of a plea bargain, the defendant and the defendant's lawyer typically have no idea how strong the prosecutor's case is because the lawyer hasn't had any time to investigate the facts and see if the prosecutor can actually make these charges stick. And because of that, well over 90% of cases are resolved through plea bargains.
Yeah, and on the defense issue, you have a chapter in the book that really highlights details that we've heard of, those of us who kind of follow these issues, research about defense counsel being less than ideal, maybe even definitely insufficient, perhaps even criminally so, that the drunk defense attorney, the drug-using defense attorney, et cetera. Are those apocryphal stories, or is this pretty prevalent across criminal justice?
Okay. They've definitely happened. Drunk attorneys, attorneys having affairs with the prosecutor, sleeping attorneys. There's a man, George McFarland, who's probably going to be executed in the next couple of years, whose attorney slept during his trial. I will admit that the vast majority of cases, attorneys do not sleep. So I'll say two things. One is that the reason we highlight those cases is, first of all, they illustrate the extreme incompetence of the lawyers that many people are saddled with, even in death penalty cases. But the second point about these lawyers is that you would think these cases would get overturned. You would think that if your lawyer sleeps during your trial, at some point you will make an appeal and a judge will say, okay, your lawyer was asleep, your right to counsel was violated, you should get a new trial. Now, so these are egregious problems that you would think would get fixed through the appeal system. So one of our points about the right to counsel, so the first one is that a lot of people are not getting good attorneys. But then I think perhaps even the more important one is that even though the Supreme Court said 60 years ago that that people accused of felonies have the right to an attorney, the Supreme Court has done little to enforce that. So when the sleeping lawyer cases get to the Supreme Court says, that's fine, your conviction will hold. And they do so for a couple of technical reasons. One is that mainly they've set the standard for attorney performance extremely low. And that's how attorneys who are asleep can be found to be competent attorneys. And if you want to say that your right to counsel was violated, you have to prove not only that your attorney was incompetent, you also have to prove that it would have made a difference, that if you had had a competent attorney, the outcome of the trial would have been different. That's extremely hard to prove. Last thing I'll say is that generally at the stage at which one typically files an ineffectiveness claim, at the point in your proceedings when you would claim you had an incompetent attorney, you actually don't have a right to an attorney. So there are many people who were convicted or in prison, did not have competent attorneys and don't have a lawyer to file that claim. In this kind of perverse sense, if you're sentenced to death, you're kind of lucky, because in most places, if you are actually sentenced to death, you will get a volunteer attorney. But you know, if you were sentenced to 25 years to life for armed robbery, you're not going to get a free attorney.
No, absolutely. And I know part of the narrative that you've laid out in the book is kind of the pipeline between the prosecutors and the judges that kind of show that the scales are really tipped in favor of the prosecution. It seems to be an institutional issue. First of all, why is it that so many of the judges are former prosecutors, and on the way up from the state judges to federal judges to even the Supreme Court, those who have practiced law have a tendency to, particularly criminal law, have had a tendency to be prosecutors, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And I think the two reasons for it. I mean, one is that prosecutors and judges in this country are elected in most places. Prosecutors are elected almost everywhere, and district attorneys, that is. And judges are elected in a large majority of states. So lower court judges in most states, even state Supreme Court justices, I believe in a majority of states. And so what does that imply? You know, in a country where a lot of people are afraid of crime, many of them irrationally so, the way to be elected either a prosecutor or a judge is to be elected prosecutor is to talk about how many criminals you have convicted. And then to become the best platform from which to run for judge is to be a district attorney. So you can say, I convicted all of these murderers. I've been protecting the community as a prosecutor, I will continue to protect the community as a judge. These are elections that typically don't get, certainly don't get the attention and the money of, say, a House of Representatives or a Senate or a gubernatorial race. And so it's you have this pattern of people running for prosecutor, claiming they'll be tough on crime, being as tough on crime as they can, then running for judge and claiming they'll be tough on crime. So it's a product of the fact that we elect people to be judges, which is extremely rare. I think there's maybe one other country in the world that does this. And that we have, you know, we have a culture that in which fear of crime is much more important than respect for the constitutional rights of people accused of crime. We have an unfortunate, you know, I would say the prevailing opinion in this country is most people don't think about criminal defendants very often. And when they do, they think, oh, they're probably guilty of something. And that's, so that's the environment in which, you know, you can be elected to be a judge, almost promising to ignore the constitutional rights of defendants.
Absolutely. And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing class, race, and inequality in the criminal justice system on the basis of a new book entitled A Fear of Too Much Justice. And we have one of the authors, James Kwok, of the Southern Center for Human Rights with us here. Since electoral politics seems to suggest people favor prosecutors, favor anybody who promises to protect the community, irrespective of the Constitution, et cetera. But there is a trend electorally that suggests that a lot of the issues that you raise in this book have made their way to the political community. Concerns about prosecutorial aggression, prosecutorial misconduct, the racial elements and the class elements have led to the election of some fairly prominent, the term we always use are, you know, progressive prosecutors, you know, in cities like Philadelphia and St. Louis, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, those immediately come to mind. Is this serving as a corrective to some of these excesses?
Well, I think it definitely is. So if you look at, as you say, since about 2015, there has been a trend of election of progressive prosecutors and in a number of cities, you know, typically cities that are solidly Democratic. And what do we mean by progressive prosecutor? It can generally mean there's a range of positions that people take. Some people promise not to seek the death penalty. Some people promise to prosecute fewer people for nonviolent offenses, to use diversion programs, for example. So there's a range of policies, and some of these people have been quite successful. So, for example, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia has really reduced the number of people being incarcerated for low-level crimes. And the studies I have seen show that there hasn't really been an increase in violent crime in Philadelphia under his tenure. He's also promised not to seek the death penalty. Philadelphia, surprisingly, is a city that historically has sent a lot of people to death row. So this is a promising trend. There are two reasons to be less positive than one might be about this. One is there's a backlash. So in Florida, Governor DeSantis has suspended at least two elected district attorneys, claiming that they are not, essentially by not prosecuting anyone that they absolutely could to get as long a sentence as they possibly could, they are not fulfilling their responsibilities. In general, in state law, state governments can do more or less what they want. So they have pretty clear supremacy over local governments. And then in San Francisco, as is, I think has gotten a lot of press, Chesa Boudin was recalled as the district attorney in San Francisco. So Chesa was a public defender before he became district attorney. And he was bitterly opposed by the police union in San Francisco. I think there's certainly speculation, there may be evidence that the police essentially cut back on doing their jobs to embarrass him. And there's been a narrative in San Francisco that there's been a huge increase in violent crime because of Chesa Boudin, which is essentially entirely false. There has been an uptick in property crime since COVID, which I know people are upset about, and they took it out on Chesa. So one is that there's a backlash. The other point is just in general, like, you know, the quality of the justice you receive shouldn't depend on whether you're accused in a blue jurisdiction or a red jurisdiction. Really, I mean, these are issues of fairness and of constitutional rights that shouldn't depend on, you know, on geographic boundaries. I mean, that said, given the choice, I would certainly vote for a progressive prosecutor. As we discussed earlier, the prosecutor is the most important person in the system. It's better to have somebody who has you know, has a background as a public defender or civil rights attorney, has an understanding of the problems with the criminal legal system. Certainly better to have somebody like that. But it's not the, you know, it's not the best long-term solution.
And part of the book suggests, I mean, if you follow the money, that could be one of the huge motivations here, and two specific issues, one of which is very much a significant political issue, is the role of cash bail, the whole cash bail system. I happen to live relatively close to courthouses in LA County, and you can see, you know, all of the bail bonds lined up. You know, it's a huge that's a huge industry, as well as, and this was something I didn't know as much of, was the financial motivations for probation in those cases. So how much of this is really being driven by the money?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think with cash bail, there are two aspects to cash bail. So there are some states that have basically outlawed the private bail bondsman industry. Kentucky, can't remember the others. So there are two issues with cash bail. So one is that, and this one applies whether or not you have you have private bondsmen or not, right? So one is simply that in many places, if you're arrested and charged for the crime, in order to go free pending trial, somebody has to post bond for you. The Supreme Court has said that in the system, there must be consideration of your ability to pay. You're not supposed to sit in jail simply because you are poor. In practice, in most places, that doesn't happen. There are some cities that have had fixed bail schedules, which means that for a given offense, the bail is the same, no matter how much money you have. That's clearly unconstitutional. And it's been overturned in a couple cities like Houston, but that was standard practice for a long time. In any case, it's very clear that poor people are sitting in jail waiting for trial, while middle class and upper middle class people who did the exact same things are not. And then on top of that, the problem with the private bail industry is that there's an industry that lives off of the existence of cash bail. And so first of all, it's an industry that, I mean, the abuses in the industry have been extensively chronicled. They do things that are, you know, basically illegal. But the political implications are that whenever you try to roll back cash bail, it's a very well-organized industry, which is very good at basically mounting fear campaigns and saying, look, if you reduce the number of offenses for which bail is required, then all these violent criminals will be on the streets and they'll be killing people. And so it's a formidable political force. I want to mention private probation also, as you mentioned. This is really an example. This is a financially driven phenomenon. So probation has been around for a long time. I think, you know, when I was a child, people thought of probation as a way to, it's an alternative to prison. And the idea is that there is a probation officer who is a government employee whose job is to kind of stay in touch with you and help you and make sure you're getting your life back on track. And I'm sure not all probation officers are wonderful people, but the basic idea of probation was to help people and deter them from committing crimes again. What's happened is that so in Georgia, which I know best because that's where the Southern Center is based, there was the industry first, they got a law passed allowing for private probation companies. And now the typical pattern of what happens is if you can't pay a fine, if you're arrested for something which could be a traffic violation, you can't pay a fine. The court says, okay, you could pay on installments, but you until you finish paying off your fine, you'll be on probation and you will have to report to this private probation company. And many of these private probation companies provide no services whatsoever. They just collect bills. So basically you're paying them for debt collection. And the reason this happens is that these private probation companies have convinced municipalities to contract with them. So this is a clear example. You know, the cash flows involved, first, I mean, typically you didn't have to pay for probation. What we've done is we've invented a new cash flow that comes out of the pockets of poor people who plead guilty to minor crimes. And it goes into this industry that really has no reason to exist, which is the private probation industry. So The Sondland Center has sued a couple of these companies for abuses. We've basically driven one out of Georgia, but this is it's an ongoing problem.
And that chapter really reminded me of all the extra charges that poor people end up having to pay for the same things that, you know, people who have a bit more means. Just a reminder that it's expensive to be poor. Sort of the last main topic I want to address then is that in the book, you highlight these areas in which the Supreme Court has ruled and has consistently ruled in favor of prosecution, consistently ruled in favor of a perpetuation of the system. And of course, I think one of the reasons for that is when we have Supreme Court justices who've practiced in criminal law, overwhelmingly they were former prosecutors. But the last Supreme Court justice that was just confirmed, Ketanji Brown Jackson, had actually practiced as a criminal defense attorney. How much of a difference is that there's now a voice on the court that views things more from the defense perspective?
Yeah, I think that Justice Jackson could have a major impact. I mean, as everyone knows, the court is split into conservative and liberal wings, which tend to vote together. So justices... Justice Kagan, for example, I don't believe has any real background or expertise in criminal law, but certainly when the Trump administration was trying to execute a dozen people in 2020 and 2021, certainly Justice Kagan and Sotomayor opposed those executions unsuccessfully, as it turned out. But I think that, you know, having somebody with the kind of experience that Justice Jackson has can be very, very helpful. I'll just cite one example, which is Thurgood Marshall, right? So Thurgood Marshall was a justice for several decades. And he was, much of that time, he was the only person who had been involved with death penalty cases at all. And so he certainly didn't get his way on every case. But for example, in the early 1960s, there was an infamous case called Swain when the Supreme Court literally said that you could discriminate in jury selection on the basis of race. If you're a prosecutor, you can eliminate somebody from the jury just because they're Black, as long as you don't do it all the time in every case. But so just horrible opinion. And, basically over the next few decades, Justice Marshall, every time there was a case with an all-white jury, he would object. And eventually he partially won that battle. So in 1986, he was still the only person. He was still the only person who had ever been involved in a death penalty case in 1986. But the United States Supreme Court finally came around to his view and said, you can no longer strike somebody from a jury because of race. The test they implemented is very weak, and so all white juries still exist. But I mean, that's an example of a battle that Justice Marshall won, largely because of his influence. And I think that, on a lot of these... Well, on some of these constitutional rights of defendants questions, it's not a foregone conclusion that all of the conservative justices will side with the prosecution. Most of them will most of the time, but Justice Scalia, for example, had a libertarian streak, right? And so he occasionally would side with the defendant. So I think in that context, Justice Jackson could, play a role in bringing around some of the conservative justices.
The title of the book is A Fear of Too Much Justice. That's actually a specific quote from, I believe it was Potter Stewart, but what does it reference?
Right, so that's from a famous case from 1987, McCluskey v. Kemp. This is the case in which a Black man accused of killing a white man contested the death penalty on the grounds that it was racially discriminatory, which in the aggregate, it absolutely is. Every study ever done, or the vast majority of studies, have shown that. And the Supreme Court majority opinion said that it upheld his conviction and death sentence. They said basically the fact that there's a systemic discrimination doesn't matter. You have to show discrimination against in your case. And one of the justifications they said was that it's because if we struck down the Georgia death penalty on these grounds, we'd have to look at we might have to look at other types of sentences. We might have to look at claims brought by other groups. We might have to look at claims brought by women, and that's just going too far. They didn't want to head down that path. And one of the justices in dissent said the majority's opinion betrays a fear of too much justice, and we chose that for the title because, well, first of all, you know, if there is an injustice, the Supreme Court is supposed to address it, not to say we don't want to take on this injustice because then we'd be obliged to take on some other kind of injustice. And we also chose it because we think it illustrates some of the problems in the criminal legal system, not just in death penalty cases. I'll just give one example. You know, we could pay for every person accused of a crime to have a competent, zealous attorney with a reasonable workload. It would cost money, but you know, we're not talking about aircraft carriers here. We're talking millions of dollars, not billions. Why don't we? Well, one reason is that if we did, then what would happen? There wouldn't be as many plea bargains. Not as many people would be convicted. Some of them might be acquitted. The kind of the machinery of the system as it stands right now would just break down. So that I think that's another example where we don't do what we should, partly because we're afraid of too much justice. So that's why we chose the title, and I think it's appropriate for a lot of the issues we talk about.
Absolutely. The title of the book is A Fear of Too Much Justice: Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the Criminal Courts. The authors are Stephen Bright, who teaches law at Yale and Georgetown University, and was the director of the Southern Center for Human Rights, and James Kwok, former professor of law at the University of Connecticut and a chair at the Southern Center for Human Rights. James Kwok, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a very enlightening conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for your time and for having me.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.